people get so passionate about both sides of the fence, and they just let it infect. And I use the word infect specifically. They let it infect every aspect of their lives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Friends, you know, investments. Politics is like, it's like a cloud, not a dark rain cloud or storm. It's just this cloud, and it kind of, what do you think of the old Blink 182 thing?
Dude, it was great. So you said they're not the same without Tom. So Tom, I guess, had left for a while, but he was back on this album because I quickly recognized he was back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That. So what's cool is one of the guys that works for me, one of my advisors, Alec, so he has some really in-depth knowledge of sort of, you know, how bands function and different things they've gone through. He kind of keeps up on those things. And he was telling me that this album, it's so good, right? The reason is it's the first time since like 2002 or three, whichever album that was, maybe it was Take Off Your Pants and Jacket, that they actually recorded in the same room. The other albums they had after that, you know, maybe Mark was in New York and Tom was in LA and Travis was somewhere else, and they would just record it independently and then they would just all mix it together. At least that's what I was told. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But he was telling me that's what he had read somewhere. But this is the first time they actually kind of got back together, kind of mended fences. And you can just hear, like, there's that one song they have. It's called Dance With Me, mm-hmm. right? Dude, that sounds so good. That reminds me of, like, Bouncing Souls. It's just, it has such good energy to it. You know, here's the thing. I'm 47, and Tom and Travis are 47. Mark is actually 51. So I was like, cool. So us dudes in our 40s, we can still bring it.
Oh my gosh. Oh, Green Day. Were you you seem like you'd be a Green
Day. Oh, yeah. Green Day is, Green Day is great. Dookie, their first album, it came out in 93. It was one of my first, it was one of the first ones I had. I think I wore that. I had a 64 Mercury Comet. That's what I drove to high school. Uh-huh. And I worked at my dad's shop, mopping floors and working in the machine shop for years. And I saved up enough money to buy an Alpine CD player. And I built a console to put an Alpine CD player inside my 64 Mercury Comet. And between Rage Against the Machine, Dookie, of course, Nirvana, Nevermind was huge back then. But yeah, you know, Green Day was good. And Green Day actually, they kind of went, they get a little political here and there. Rage Against the Machine does that. And of course, you know, if you're in a, I mean, rock music or whatever, anything that's related to that, most of those guys are, you know, all kind are cut from the same cloth, and they all kind of have the same belief structure. And I just don't like necessarily politics in my music. I just kind of want to listen to a good beat and kind of forget about things for a while. So sometimes that stuff gets a little bit trying, you know what I mean? It's like, okay. We don't really need to, you know, but I get that's how bands function, right? They have their passions or whatever, and that's what moves them, and that's what makes the music. But so I get it. It's kind of a weird, I guess, a trade-off.
Now would probably be a great time. 13 minutes, 4 stock recommendations, and pissing off probably 3/4 of the country with political talk.
Yep.
We'll say, hey, welcome to the Intelligent Investment Market Update. I'm Garrett Lill here with Matt Dahl. And as always, anything that we say about individual stocks or anything else is not construed to be investment advice. And pretty much all your hate mail, I will leave Matt's email address in the description. Feel free to pass along your comments to him. So, hey, thanks for joining us, man. I think there's your ADD break of the day brought to you by Adderall, because I completely forgot to even say hello in the beginning. So welcome to the show.
Well, that's how we roll. We just start going. We started with Blink 182, and now we're talking about Target's politics.
And I'll be honest with you, I'm about 80% sure that this is the raw take so far. I don't think I'm editing a thing from what we've said so far. I think that's exactly the way the show's going to come out.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, if we were going to get raw, let's get raw, right? You and I, we have these discussions, and I tell my advisors and I tell my clients, I tell them, like, don't let your politics get in your investments. Don't, because you'll make emotion. Because the whole point of what we do is to remove emotion from the markets, right? Earnings are good, economy is good, blah, 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 blah. There's all these indicators to say things are going to be okay. The market's just going through a bit of a catharsis, whatever. But don't let these emotionally generated decisions or things that stir your emotions get into your politics.
But do you not think that they know exactly what they're doing with that? Because I don't think that they're putting their personal views into it at all. My personal opinion is that they have done thorough research analysis and figured out who their target audience is, and they're playing to that target audience's belief system. And yes, probably doing it as controversially as possible to get their customer base fighting with somebody else about the views of their thing to keep their name in the headlines. So would you, I mean, I'm sorry, maybe I'm crazy, but there's got to be a little bit of that going on, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, but that comes from their personal belief that it's okay.
Oh, that's true.
You know what I'm saying? But, like that's okay.
But if the CEO of XYZ company, and I like to say XYZ company, because that keeps me out of hot water since I don't trade stocks for anybody. But if the CEO of XYZ company says that, you know, they want to come out in support of whatever agenda you want to put out there on either side of the aisle, I don't care, because they have done research to know that that's going to be what's best for their bottom line. You're not necessarily saying that that's because that CEO agrees with that value. You're saying that they just do, they put the politics of their audience in play when it, you don't think it should be, but it's not necessarily what they even believe. You think they just put up whatever they need to stir things up.
Well, whether they personally believe it and they would vote that way or they wouldn't vote that way, you know, is immaterial. The fact that they would allow it is endorsement enough.
Yeah.
You know, because frankly, when I take my 6-year-old son to Disneyland, right? Mm-hmm. I want him to, you know, take a picture with Mickey Mouse and go to the Haunted Mansion and go on, you know, the roller coasters and, you know, enjoy the day. There shouldn't be this weird political overhang, you know, that kind of follows you. No, same thing with Bud Light. No one wants to drink Bud Light and be thinking about, you know, some sort of a transgender debate. Like, I just want to have a beer and watch a football game. Is that okay with you? Can I just have a beer and watch a football game and not worry about whether, you know, I'm supporting or not supporting a transgender agenda? I'm just, it's gotten crazy. So,
hey, you know, congratulations, Matt. We've officially, on an investment related podcast, I'm officially going to have to check the box that says explicit content for the first time on a podcast.
it's like, you know, these guys are just that gets into the judgment of a portfolio manager.
Yeah, right? I was going to say, maybe we should probably get back on rail here for a second.
Yeah, well, yeah, this thing, but that gets into the judgment of the portfolio manager. Okay, so do I trust the judgment of these CEOs?
Well, but
that would allow.
Let's define what we're talking about here, though, because if we're talking about, we started off talking about a client and their personal beliefs about a certain, you know, owning a certain company. And then we kind of extended that upstream to a cause of that, which are these companies that are pushing, you know, their own political agendas or whatever, for whatever reason the case may be. So my question, maybe before we get too far off on that, is back to that client, because I've had that situation before as well. And I mean, I've had clients that refuse to buy certain stocks because of one side. And then I've had other clients on the same book of business that refuse to buy stocks on the opposite side. And my personal belief was always basically to make sure I communicated to them what that changed. Okay. So I'll give an example of someone who did not want to own a sector-based ETF, because within that sector-based ETF, there were, you know, three holdings that were against their core beliefs that made up a total of, you know, 7% of the portfolio or 14% of the portfolio. So what I went in and did is I reconstructed. It was fortunately a big enough account that I, you know, it could withstand this. I reconstructed the top 10 holdings of that ETF and replaced those two with the 11th and 12th. And, you know, they ended up getting 60% probably correlation to the movement of the index without the stocks that they didn't want. And, you know, that's able to, we can work that out, but I can explain to them the pros and cons of that, you know, and make sure that they understand it. But I would say this, and this is maybe to play devil's advocate, and I don't even know if I'm playing devil's advocate because you haven't really answered your side of my question yet because I haven't asked it. But it's part of the fun. When I was an advisor, I guess I looked at it like this. We talked a little bit, I don't know if it was on the show or not, but about me doing some football coaching with my son's team. And what was interesting about that is that, you know, we didn't have every single ingredient that you would love to have. I'd love to have a, you know, 5'10" quarterback that can throw it 45 yards and a 5'9" receiver that can run fast and catch it. You have to work with what you got to work with, though, right? If a client comes to you and says, this is how I, you know, these are my beliefs, I think as an advisor, you know, we better be accommodating to that, or somebody else is going to come along who is. And some advisors specialize in not accommodating that, and I think that's fine as well. But if you are building a broader book and you're trying to appeal to a broad audience, you have to allow for some customization to that. But then what I would say is, I think it's something that the client needs to define it in advance, not seven innings into a game that's not going our way yet, and now all of a sudden we don't believe in the stock. That's something you need to be careful about. You need to make sure you know what the ingredients are before you try to bake the cake. So I don't know if there was a question buried in any of that, but surely the good.
No, I know what you're getting at here. Let's flip it, right? Let's say Disney, instead of when we bought it at 150, instead of it being at 80, let's say it was at 300. Would that phone call have happened yesterday? I don't know. You know what I mean? Who knows? So core beliefs, okay, that's fine. But a lot of that kind of tends to go away with performance of a company, whether you agree with it or you don't. And that's kind of the overall point of, you know, don't let your politics infect it, because let's say that situation did occur, you know. And by the way, I had very similar conversations regarding Meta. We're not giving stock advice here, but very similar questions regarding Meta. It was last year when Meta was having a tough time, and I said, you know, it's a strong company. They have great growth. They're trading at a very reasonable price of their growth. All of those things. But people had sort of some fundamental belief issues with that company. I said, you know, listen, I have every reason to believe it's going to recover its share price in a relatively short period of time, and it's up over 100% this year. Meta started this year at $124, $125, and we're at 300. So we more than doubled. You know, it's done incredibly well this year. So, you know, but I've not gotten any phone calls, by the way, on Meta. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah. Yeah.
Zero phone calls on, we're up 150%.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there's this, clients tend to listen to you sort of, and you want to be, and to your point, yeah, you want to be accommodating, because obviously anybody can come in there and steal, like, yeah, those people are bad. You wouldn't want to put your money into a company like that. You know, they do all these horrible things and they think all these terrible things. And then they sort of, they solicit to the client's, you know, core belief structure rather than their intellectual, you know, quantitative side. And that's really hard to fight against. It just is, you know? So you have to be able to be flexible in those situations, depending on the client, depending on how long the client's been there. I mean, you know, if there's a lot of factors that go into that decision process, but you know, you just want to make sure that you're dismissive of the client's beliefs and wishes and wants, but you're also not letting them do exactly what you tell them not to do on a daily basis, which make an emotional decision, wherever that emotion comes from, whether it's your politics or whatever, what have you. You want to make sure that they're not making these emotional decisions. And again, back to, let's juxtapose Disney and Meta in 2023. I had a similar amount of, I don't believe in these companies and their belief and what they feel about, how they feel about things in their politics last year. I've had zero calls on Meta this year. I've had a lot of calls on Disney. What's the difference? Well, Meta's up 150%. Disney's down 40%. So I'm guessing that has something to do with it.
Oh man, I don't miss that part of this at all.
So, yeah.
Oh my gosh. If you do your job right, a client will always be mad at you for something. You know what I mean? Like, did I tell you about the client that, my gosh, there's no way you'll ever hear this. Did I ever tell you about the client who literally got mad at me over the options thing and like told me one thing one month and then told me the complete opposite the next month?
No.
This is totally worth telling. I'm sorry. This is worth an ADD break. So 2015, 2016, the market just falls to hell in a handbasket like 2 months after I start my RIA.
Right. Yeah, I remember that. That was like that summer, like late July of 2015. Then it went up. Then it crashed back down in January, February 2016.
That's right. So in the immediate crash, I had this client. I mean, the market goes down 10% in 3 days, and his account went down too. And I was pretty happy about that. But we also sold a bunch of stuff because it was chaotic, and I needed to sell the put options because the VIX went so high that those things were crazy expensive. But to keep the risk in line, I had to sell some stocks to go along with it. And he just saw me selling a bunch of things at a big loss and thought I was an idiot. And I said, yeah, but look at what your overall portfolio did during this time. All right, so the market muddles along for a few months, doesn't really do anything except move a lot of up and down and not really move any direction. And then in January, from a decent high point, it goes down about another 15%. Now, during that time, he calls me and he's like, everything that you're buying right now is losing money except these put option thingies. And I want you to stop buying and trading all this other stuff. You can still do the put option thingies, but I need you to stay away from all this other stuff. I just want to sell everything except the put options. I said, okay, well, let me explain something to you. Those put options are insurance against everything else in the portfolio. If I sell everything else and just buy that stuff, then it's just betting against the market. And right. This isn't going to work.
That's how those thingies work.
Yeah. So I'm being very literal, and that's exactly his terminology. That's why I'm being so specific. So anyway, you fast forward a little bit. Now, I ended up winning some element of this argument because I did not just end up building him a put option index. But somehow or another, a month later, he calls me back and is like, don't buy any more of those put option thingies. Every single one of them are losing money, and everything else is finally working, but everything, these option thingies keep losing money. Just stop. And I think it was around that time that it was like, I knew it was coming. I didn't really tell him to transfer his account, but it was just like, do what you're going to do, man. Like, I have nothing left at this point. Like, because it's literally a month later, you're just not understanding it. And it's all these are things that these conversations we had just had 6 months prior, this is how this is going to work. And it's just, at the end of the day, the overall outcome was good, but the client didn't understand each piece of it. And that's one of the really, really tough things about the job, man, is someone told me this a long time, and I may have said this on the show the other day, but the smarter you become, the harder it becomes to articulate what you know to the average person because the gap gets bigger. So
that's not hard for me at all.
And that's a difficult, how do you fight against that? I mean, I think that's where the really brilliant minds of the industry and the ones who really end up putting up rock star careers are the ones who do figure out a way to bridge that gap, because the smartest people in the world talk in ways that I just don't understand. I'm sure they're right. I just have to take them at their word for it, right? And somebody told me that early in my career, and I wish I'd listened to it more because I worked on it for a while, and then I finally got to a point where I thought I was smart enough that it didn't matter, that I could overcome it. And boy, that was really stupid. But I think that it does become difficult because you don't want to be condescending to those who do know what you know, but you don't want to talk over the people's head who don't, and there's such a wide range where people could fall, you don't really know where it's at. So, but that's the most difficult thing about being an advisor, is taking that gap and bridging it and helping them to understand, okay, yes, at the end of the day, are you allowed to, you know, is it ideal to let your political views wag the dog of your investment style? Well, no, not if we're taking a purely capitalistic view. But if you're going to take that stance, then you're clearly articulating that your core beliefs are worth sacrificing financial gain. And that's okay. People do that. If an advisor refuses to work with a client just because they don't want to own a certain stock, that's the equivalent of saying, I don't want to work with you because you want to donate XYZ to this charity or that charity. It's what you do with your money is up to you. If you want to leave, you know, money on the table for your beliefs, that's fine with me. But you have to make sure that you're not doing what I, you know, what you're experiencing now is that it wasn't a core belief when it was up 200%. It's a core belief when it's down 50%. And that right. I get. That's a frustrating thing to have to deal with, because that's emotions that are reacting in real time, not
prepared. Well, don't let your emotions, don't let your politics infect your investments, right? We keep saying that over and over. Well, that goes on both sides of the fence. So, you know, I mean, if the portfolio is up, if that position is up, all of a sudden, you know, now they don't matter, or they did matter when it was down. It's okay in either scenario, but you can't, what happens, nothing ever happens in a vacuum and stays that way, right? Because once you start going down that road, it becomes slippery, yeah, right? It tends to take on a life of its own. Those things, okay. And then, you want to sell this, you want to sell. Next thing you know, you've got, these person's portfolio, and it's frankly not a very good portfolio based on what we as portfolio manager and analysts look at, right? But it's what the client wants. Well, then you have to step way back and say, well, do you need me at this point? Because this isn't our portfolio. This is your belief structure that you're investing in. So you don't need me for this. You know what I mean? Because now most of portfolio is things that you want in there. Whether it does good or it does bad or whatever, it's not really, we're not really managing your money in there. We're just simply transacting on behalf of your emotions and beliefs, which, well, now as a fiduciary, is that okay? I don't know. That's kind of a big question.
So now we're getting back into a little bit more of a generic kind of middle ground conversation. So this is kind of fun. So I've had this happen to me too, right? And I'll tell you a story. This is a client that if he does happen to hear the show, I'd be cool with him hearing this story because he handled it great and it was awesome. But I had a client who at one point, his account had gotten to a point where he wanted to diversify and do a few different things. And we just kind of threw stuff at the wall and was like, let's try this, let's try that. I mean, in a confined, educated, strategic way, but we explored a few different things. Well, and then he would always randomly call in and say, buy 10,000 of this, buy 10,000 of that. Well, what was funny about it is that there were times there where mine were getting killed and his were doing well. But I will say he's one of the only clients, maybe the only client, who ever, when the tide shifted, 6 months later and mine rallied back and were kicking ass and his were struggling, he called it back out and pointed it out to me then and actually said, you know what, now yours are actually doing a little bit better. I guess it makes a little bit more sense. But it was cool because it was never a competition between he and I. But that's the only environment I've ever been able to have there where the client makes their own decisions and you make your own and you don't end up getting graded somehow on it. Because even when I was down to him, he wasn't throwing it in my face. It was just he understood his way of diversifying, right? It wasn't that he didn't trust me. He just wanted to throw some of his stuff in there because I think in his own little, maybe he didn't know that this would be the exact words, but what I would say is that he knew that there was a very weak correlation between his good ideas and mine, and that was a good way to start trying to diversify a little bit. I got a problem with that, but that's the way he kept it. That's a very hard way. That's not going to happen probably 99% of the time. They're going to automatically grade themselves versus you.
Well, so, that happens quite a bit, and here's why. So the best in the world, the best, call the biggest hedge funds in the world, right? The Ray Dalios of the world, the David Teppers, those types, okay? They try to bat 600.
David Tepper could bat 600 and put a football team together.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he's right down there by you. Yeah. So, but that's the goal. You buy your portfolio set, okay, and then a year later, are you 600? Are 60% of the positions in that portfolio positive, or the based on the market, whatever? Okay, that's kind of the goal is to bat 600. That's hard to do. If people think that's very, 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 very hard to do. Okay, so. We're right there. We put a tremendous amount of effort and energy. This year we're a bit better than that. We've had years where we're a bit worse than that. We try to stay in that rough area, and we do a pretty good job of it. That means, what does that mean? That means there's 40% that have gone the other way. So let's take a scenario where a client calls and says, I want to own this because this person has. This CEO has superpowers and they have found the next thing that will cause humanity to revolutionize itself. And okay, so you do that. You put that stock in or this is a good safe company and I think the market's going to go down or for whatever reason they have that they want, call any stock, United Health all the way down to, Whirlpool. Okay. I want to put in Whirlpool because I've had this happen to you. I want Whirlpool because I've had Whirlpool in my house since 1972 and gosh darn, not a single one of them has ever broken down. And every 10 years I replace my Whirlpool appliances. Okay. That's fine. And I double dog dare you to argue with that one. You know, like, I'm not winning this argument. There's no chance I'm winning this argument. So we buy Whirlpool. You buy Whirlpool. Now you have, you know that there's 40% of your stocks likely are probably not going to go up, right? Because that's just how the whole, that's how the law of averages work and what we do. So when the client calls it, well, yeah, you see my Whirlpool compared to your, you know, Disney. Well, yeah, but what about the other 15, 16 stocks that are outperforming Whirlpool? They won't do that. What they'll do is they'll usually pick out the ones that are doing bad, you know, that's in the portfolio. Say, you should have just put Whirlpool in their place. Like, okay. Okay. So there's this sort of like, I get to use my hindsight and pick on the portfolio manager who has to look at, you know, 100 different stocks and pick out the best ones. And whether, and, you know, for them, it's a roll of the dice, you know, but but to be fair, it's kind of fun. And if I'm being 100% honest, for the first 10 years or so, I was really, of my career, I was dismissive. I was dismissive of client input on just general anecdotal data. Okay. And that, I learned that that was a mistake. You know, I learned that that was a mistake. There, sometimes you kind of have to read the tea leaves. And we, I look at FactSet all day, and I look, you know, I look at the DeMarc counts all day, and I go through all of my macro research all day. And it gives me a good idea of what's happening. Like PCE came out today. It was right on consensus. GDP came out yesterday, blew the cover off the ball. Economy's doing fine. But I had a dinner a few weeks ago with a friend. He's actually a plastic surgeon. And he's like, you know, my consults are down from 15 a day to 8. Okay. That's the upper end of discretionary income people. Right. And they're tightening up. They're tightening up a little bit. And, you know, 7-8 years ago, I would have been dismissive of that, but now I'm not. I'm like, okay, well, there's something to that. So when clients come to me with ideas and feelings and beliefs, I tend to try to keep a more open ear now than I did in my younger days. You know what I mean? Because it's not that they're wrong or they're right, but it's something that maybe you're not, it might be an area or a consideration set that you're not really spending any energy on. And it's valuable, whether it turns out to be or not, who knows, right? Should we actually talk about a market update?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, we've not updated at all. I was looking at it. We're down about 5% or so overall since our last chat on the 13th. Is that right?
We were at 40. We're about 4250. So we're about 4120 now on the S&P. So yeah, I've done about 3 or 4 somewhere in that range.
Tell us a little bit about what's driving that a little bit, because I haven't been keeping up with the day-to-day news swing. So what's been behind that from what you've watched?
Well, so frankly, it's nonsense in my opinion. We've had rates increase. In fact, it went to 502 at one point. And the reason that happened, obviously, you know, the GDP came out strong. We've just had this never-ending rise in interest rates, and that's really just put a headwind on equities. It's caused this buyer strike, right? And then earnings have started to come out, and that's been sort of this. It's given this energy to the sell side, and frankly, I don't really understand why. Okay, I mean, we have 80%. Of the companies on the S&P beating their estimates by 6%, which is good. Let's pick on Google for a second. Okay. Let's look what happened to Google. Google was down 9.5% the day after earnings. Okay. So you would think, well, they must have missed earnings. Something must have happened. Consensus estimates for earnings for Q3, $1.46 a share. They came in at $1.55. They had a 6.2%. They beat their estimate by 6.2%. Sales beat by 1%. They had $7.59 billion sales estimate for Q3. Came in at $7.67 billion. Okay. One of their units, the Google Cloud, missed its revenue target. So the street punished it by nearly 10% the next day because they consider that its growth engine. And to some extent, they're, of course, they're not wrong. I mean, they're the market. So the markets, if the market's wrong or the market's right, it doesn't matter. It's right because that's what the decision is, right? So, but if you look at the overall, what's more of a barometer, I mean, Google search, Google advertising, that did really, really well. Mm-hmm. That, and so they missed one of their big, which makes up about 10% or so of their revenue, the Google Cloud, missed it by a little bit. Yeah, the 90% did really, really well, which is why they beat overall by 6.2%. And they got punished by 9.5% of the stock the next day. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a $2 trillion company,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, it lost the market cap of four Ford Motor Companies the next day. Three Fords. It was that's crazy.
On an earnings.
And you look at Amazon knocked it out of the park last night. Okay. They're doing up. They're up 6 or 7%. They're up 7% today. And they beat estimates quite a bit. They had consensus earnings at 59 cents a share. They beat it by 60%. Earnings of 94 cents a share. $141 billion in sales estimate. They came in $143 billion in sales. So, talk about knocking the cover off the ball. They did. I mean, they absolutely did it. And they're up, 6.5-7%. They're up less than Google was down when they beat earnings too. So Meta just destroyed earnings, destroyed revenue. They gave on the earnings call, and they were up like 5-6% after hours that day. That was Wednesday. So after hours, they're up. Then Susan Lee came on. She's the CFO of Meta, and gave guidance in regards to advertising dollars that could be affected due to the Middle East conflict. And that's it. That's all. That's all it was. And and you just saw right after she said that, it lost. It was down 4% after hours. So when rates are where they are, when money is this expensive and you have this much tight, you have this much tightening of financial conditions, or financial conditions are tight as they are right now, there is just no room for error. And every time, just the whisper of the potential idea of a softening and guidance sometime in the future that may or may not ever occur, companies are just getting absolutely taken to the woodshed for it. Even in their beating guidance, even if they're not actually lowering their guidance. And that's what I'm finding. And that's what I'm finding really frustrating about this market. But you look at the overall, things are fine. Again, GDP came out at a 4.9% annualized rate last quarter on consensus of 3.7. The economy's growing. Here's a good thing. Let's look at credit. The credit market is where I tend to spend a lot of my time. And you can do something. You can look at the distressed credit, like the triple C's versus the double B. So you're talking about high yield junk bonds against really, really bad junk bonds, like the distressed level junk bonds. That spread is narrowing, which, if the economy was weakening, those real soft companies that have real poor credit ratings, the triple C's, people would be selling off that debt like crazy. And they're not. They're actually they're selling off the other high yield bonds at a higher rate. Then they're selling off the distress because they're getting such high yield on the triple C's. And let's take that exact comparison and move it up again to the investment grade corporate versus just high yield. So the LQD, which is investment grade corporate bonds, it's down 7% in the last 3 months. 7%. Okay. So people have sold off those corporate bonds just like they sold off treasuries, all the whole thing. But let's look at high yield. High yield bonds down 2.6 in the same time. So it's down, but they're holding on to those high yield bonds a lot more than they're holding on to the investment grade because they're getting a better yield out of it. And they know there's really no issues of them servicing the debt, right? So we're not seeing, and if you look at the simple, the B of A ICE high yield spread from treasuries to corporates, it's at 4.5. It's fine. So the credit market is smooth, it's orderly. It's narrowing where it's supposed to be narrowing. It's spreading where it's supposed to be spreading, or it's widening where it's supposed to be widening, but it's not wide, and it's not, there's no velocity to it. Everything is kind of moving in concert with each other. If there was really a problem, we would see the HYG LQD relationship would be absolutely reversed. The other thing I look at, this is kind of the thing that I've tended to do, and I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I'm starting to, so far it's not been a bad idea yet. Is I look at crypto, I look at Bitcoin. No, I don't buy Bitcoin. I'm not making any sort of a call on Bitcoin. Zero. I don't know crypto. I spend no time looking at it at all. I don't do any research on it. I really don't understand it all that much. To me, it feels like a solution to a problem. Okay, there. So I said all that. But what I look to Bitcoin for is pure risk appetite. Okay. Is there risk appetite out there? Okay. And we're seeing Bitcoin's up like 10% in the last couple of weeks, 3 weeks. It's actually skyrocketed from about 26,000. It's over 30,000 today. It's over 33,000 today. Okay. It's gone up quite a bit in the last 3 weeks. Now, in tighter financial conditions, you would think that shouldn't work, but it is. And I've noticed that, and again, I haven't spent a tremendous amount of time doing this comparative analysis, but I tend to see Bitcoin lead the equity markets in time as far as what Bitcoin does about 3 weeks later, the equity markets, 4 weeks later, the equity markets start to do. It tends to lead the markets as far as down and up, not necessarily in magnitude, but in time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the fact that Bitcoin hasn't fallen out of bed, I mean, in 2022 when rates were going up and everything was going down, Bitcoin got crushed. It went from over 60,000 to, you know, whatever it was, 12 or 13,000. Well, since rates have been going up through this back half of October, Bitcoin has gone up. Equities have gone down. You know, so we're seeing this divergence, but I think we're seeing the divergence because Bitcoin tends to bottom sooner and rally sooner than the equities, because that's kind of that first knife's razor's edge of risk appetite out there. You know what I mean? And this is just my personal feelings. I have not spent a tremendous amount of time doing that. Like, well, exactly, you know, but there's an average of 3.7 weeks between the Bitcoin bottom and the equity. No, I haven't done any of that.
Bitcoin's an interesting one. I have a theory on how it could make sense in a portfolio, regardless of whether you like it as an investment, but that's a completely different conversation for a different day. And I certainly do not want to get into the weeds of it sounding like I might be recommending or not recommending Bitcoin. But that's an interesting conversation just in general. The crypto thing really exploded onto the scene over the last few years. And I don't know, it's controversial in itself. So, well, I think, believe that's about all the time we got today, Matt. Really appreciate it, man. I really feel like we're starting getting into our little, getting into a rhythm here. I don't know if that's good or bad, but we're finding our frequency. We'll see if anybody else likes it.
Well, you know, I'm antisocial, so if they don't like it, they don't have to. As long as I have someone to talk with every couple of weeks, that makes me happy, and that's all I care about.
You know what? Maybe at the end of the day, it's one of those things. Sometimes we do these podcasts. I don't care if anybody's listening. We'll record it, and if they stop listening, we'll stop recording. It's all right. We can
right,
talk.
Right. Right. So.
All right. Talk to you soon, my man.
All right, dude. See ya. People get so passionate about both sides of the fence, and they just let it infect. And I use the word infect specifically. They let it infect every aspect of their lives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Friends, you know, investments. Politics is like, it's like a cloud, not a dark rain cloud or storm. It's just this cloud, and it kind of